supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got one of those jam-packed shows for you this week, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we'll talk about the wisdom of using peanut shells as a mulch or compost ingredient. And in a little bit, we'll be talking to our old friend and common sense pest control advisor, Bill Quarles, about all the press bed bugs have been getting lately. You won't want to miss any of it. So we better get right to your fascinating phone calls right away at 1-888-346-9499. Mark, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, thanks, Mike. How you doing?
I am doing very well. Mark, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, and I'm in Yukon, Oklahoma. We're just west of Oklahoma City.
Okay.
I guess we're considered a suburb.
What can we do for Mark near Oklahoma City?
Well, this is my second season of gardening. And I started some seedlings indoors back in January, which now I'm finding was a bit too early.
Yeah, you jumped the gun a little bit there, Mark, but only by like 3 months. You know?
Only, that's it. So maybe a little overambitious, but, you know, I started over 100 different types of seeds, and I'm down to about 50 healthy plants now. But the problem is, I am out of space and out of tolerance from my wife.
Yeah, it's
taking up our guest bedroom, and I've got to move them to the garage here shortly. Now,
well, they qualify as guests, though, Mark. They're not going to stay.
They've been pleasant house guests, but they've worn out their welcome, according to my wife. So
yeah, I hear that. We just had a little marital discussion about where the last of the grow lights was going to be set up, because I realized I didn't have the old space I used to have. And, you know, there's always room for one more. But as plants get big, as tomatoes and peppers and eggplants, you know, get to full size, God, they take up a lot of room, and their need for light has increased dramatically. So do you have plant lights all over the house, or are you hoping for sunny windowsill miracles?
I have a guest bedroom full of different types of grow lights that I've acquired over the last year. I've got some of the larger fluorescent grow lights. I've got actually one shelf of nothing but LED grow lights, which I've had great success with, surprisingly enough.
Tell me about your experience. Everybody asks me about LEDs, and I know nothing except that they seem to get better and brighter all the time.
Absolutely, and one thing I've noticed is that all of the LED panels that I have gotten have had red and blue LEDs, and apparently those are the right spectrum for plant growth, and they're so cool to the touch that the leaves can literally be touching the bulbs, and it's not going to burn the leaves.
And you say your plants are nice and stocky and are responding well to the LEDs?
They have responded better to the LEDs than the fluorescent shop lights that I've been using.
Excellent. Now, in terms of when you can go outside, I'm figuring that your last average frost date is around May 15th. It's not going to be earlier than May 1st.
We will probably get a good hard frost towards the end of April, early May. And from that point on, it's usually the risk of frost has gone away.
You talked about a garage. Is that a possible halfway house for these plants?
Yeah, I have to get them out of that guest bedroom. So I thought that the garage would be a good halfway house, as you said, to put them in, and it does not get as cold in there at night.
Right.
And I could easily pull them outside during the day when it's warm.
And it's not heated, though.
It is not heated.
Yeah, I think you should start moving them out, because it's going to take a while to arrange the new lighting setup. And what I might suggest you do is just go out and buy a big roll of heavy plastic and try to, you know, just do it a cheap and shoddy and sleazy insulation of the door, especially if you can create a system where you can just roll the plastic up out of the way in the morning. And then any day it's going to go up into the 60s, bright sun. They would love to get outside. And you can leave them out if the temperatures are going to stay in the 50s. It's perfectly okay, and the plants seem to enjoy going out into this weather. Even if they have to come back in for a couple of weeks, make sure you keep moving them up into bigger containers, and they should be being fed right now as if they were out in the garden.
I've been putting worm castings, you know, on top of the soil mix. Is that appropriate, or do they need more than that right now?
That's perfect for right now. That's absolutely perfect.
Great.
So, you know what? You made a mistake, but it was a mistake of passion. It shows a great love for plants. It seems like you're really paying attention. I think this will just become a funny story in the future, and you're going to have a longer harvest than anybody in the neighborhood. But don't do it again next year.
I think I have learned my lesson.
Good man. You have good luck, and you tell your wife that I forgive you, even if she doesn't.
Be very forgiving once we start getting these great tomatoes and peppers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Have a great season, man.
Thank you, Mike.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Connie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. I live in Anderson, Indiana.
Okay, very good. How are you?
I'm fine. And yourself?
I am doing very well. Thank you.
My question today is, we have a 32-year-old blue spruce tree in our front yard that has grown very tall, and our neighbors also have trees that has shaded our tree. They're going to have theirs cut down, and where theirs have shaded ours is kind of thin, the
right.
Branches. I want to know if I would shoot it with nutrients and fertilizer if it would help the tree to fill out.
No, people's instincts with these kind of plant problems always seem to lean towards things that would be negative. Feeding a plant that's in distress or pruning a plant that's in distress. I will tell you that you discovered one of the hazards of growing an otherwise beautiful evergreen.
Yes.
Is that they are only full if they get full sun on all sides. And a lot of times, the first thing that goes is the bottom branches, because other plants and even the tree itself begins to shade the base of the tree. And then if the sun is blocked from one side, at the very least, that tree is not going to be as full in that area. How is the base of your tree?
Well, this year we did have to take out a few of the bottom branches because they have died off, but my husband said that was because it was getting old.
Well, he's right and he's wrong. An old tree that's sitting out in the open that has nothing around it, and you've seen these branches are skirts that hide the very ground underneath the tree, and they're still lush and green or blue, whatever color they're supposed to be. But it is more typical as the tree gets older for less and less sun to get down there. It's a very simple equation. Sun equals fullness on these evergreens, which is why in Christmas tree farms and stuff, there's so much work done to clear out trees that don't look too good anymore so that they're not blocking the sunlight on the other trees. When are your neighbor's trees coming down?
This month.
Okay. And you say your tree is, did you say 30 years old?
32.
Oh, okay. Does it have birthdays? Do you put a little hat on it or something?
Yeah. Well, I know because we planted when my oldest daughter was 2. So she's going to be 34, so the tree is 32.
Oh, that is so wonderful. Was this a live Christmas tree?
Yes.
And you guys obviously did it correctly, and you kept the tree alive and used it and planted it outside successfully.
Yes.
Oh, that is so great. Well, what do you do for it now? Do you feed it? Do you prune it? Do you mulch it?
No.
Okay.
None of those things.
Okay. Oh, how tall is it, though?
Maybe 30 feet.
Yeah.
It's tall.
When their trees come down, I want you to be prepared or to have already spread an inch of compost around the base of your spruce.
Okay.
And water it in. If this summer turns very dry and hot, do some supplemental water. Let a hose drip at the base of the tree all night long, once a week. If you don't get rain and it's brutally hot, The combination of the compost and supplemental watering during drought will encourage the fullest growth the tree is capable of giving you. Other than that, a professional pruning in the spring, going around and shortening some long branches, very cleverly pruning it more into a Christmas tree shape, but very gently. I'm talking about taking off very small amounts, but over a large part of the tree, which is going to be difficult for the size, that would also make it appear more full. But the way to do this, quote, for free, without a lot of work or without having an expert come out and really shear it wonderfully for you, which would be just taking inches off all around the parts of the tree that are the longest, is with some compost. And again, supplemental watering when it gets hot. This is the summertime when your tree is going to have the best shot at filling in any of those bare spots. You'll know by the end of the summer what the tree is capable of doing.
Okay. Now, the compost, you said, put it at the base of the tree. How far out?
You start about 4 to 6 inches from the trunk. You don't ever mulch the trunk of a tree. But then you go out as far as the furthest branch goes.
Okay. Very good.
All right. And it sounds wonderful. And congratulations on having that kind of an heirloom Christmas tree. It's a wonderful thing to have done.
Thank you. You have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and transfer my tomato and pepper seedlings into larger containers and give them the first gentle feeding of their hopefully soon-to-be tasty little lives. It's so exciting this time of year. But don't you go watering worm castings into your boxcar willies just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls, the wisdom of using peanut shells as a mulch, and some straight talk about bed bugs. You don't want to miss it. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible with support from Seed Savers Exchange, whose 2011 Heirloom Seed Catalog, offering nearly 600 varieties, is now available. Learn more at seedsavers.org.
It's 1119. This is WHYY.
Network for New Music supports WHYY. Cherry blossoms in the spring form the perfect backdrop for the music of Debussy and Japanese composer Toro Takemitsu, with new video by Gene Coleman. The network ensemble also performs a world premiere by international star Dai Fujikura and his chamber work for Sho, Koto, and Western Ensemble. One performance only on Friday, April 15th at 8 p.m. at International House, Philadelphia. Tickets online at networkfornewmusic.org.
Supporting WHYY, Morris Arboretum celebrates Japanese Cherry Blossom Festival Saturday, April 9th, with events beginning at 11 a.m., from Japanese swordsmanship to a traditional tea ceremony and more. Details at morrisarboretum.org.
Supporting WHYY, Backyard Farmers, offering organic products to turn your backyard into a family food-producing experience. From vegetable gardens to hen houses to rainwater harvesting systems. More at backyardfarmers.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, peanut hulls are a locally available resource, but are they a wise choice for mulching your garden beds or for making your compost? We'll have the surprising answer when we get to the question of the week. We'll also take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our special and frequent guest, Bill Quarles, the director of the BIRC, the Biointegral Resource Center in Berkeley, California. Bill is the editor of two journals that I subscribe to, the IPM Practitioner and Common Sense Pest Control. The latest issue of the IPM Practitioner has a cover feature called Don't Let the Bed Bugs Bite, and we thought this would be the perfect opportunity to tackle this annoying subject on our show. Bill Quarles, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. How you doing?
Oh, always good to talk with you, Bill. You know, bed bugs, I had a conversation with you when I was asking you to be on the show. I have second thoughts about doing anything on bed bugs because I'm afraid the topic freaks people out.
I think it does. It's certainly a big topic in the media. I think that maybe there's too much hysteria about bed bugs. They certainly are resurgent, but they don't carry diseases. And so basically the problem is that they have a social stigma associated with them. And also it's a nuisance to get bitten in the middle of the night by something that you don't know what it is.
Right, unless it's the person next to you. Let's talk first about the realities. There have been a tremendous amount of stories about bed bugs in the news today. This is not news to you. This is something you've been reporting on for a while now.
Oh, yeah. In fact, we did actually articles in the 80s on bed bugs.
Now, Bill, I'm going to put you on the spot here. A lot of people already listening to us right now have parasitosis, right? All they can think about is there's something crawling on them or something waiting for them to get tired. And it's very easy to wake up with what appear to be little bites or little rashes on your body.
The thing is that you can inspect and find them if you really, really look. And sooner or later, if you have them, you're going to find the infestation. You're going to actually see them.
And now, what are we going to see, and when are we going to see it? Because these things defy description.
Right. I think that if you really think you have bed bugs, the thing you ought to do is to really inspect your bed, take the sheets off, the bedding off, perhaps wash it in hot water, take a look at the mattress, look along the seams, look for cream-colored eggs about the size of a pinhead. Look for discarded skins, look for blood spots, or even live bugs.
And what would a live bug be? Let's say these are creatures who, like many insects, they have an egg stage, and then I believe they hatch out and they have several progressive stages, like
right.
Four or five.
The first stage is about the size of a pinhead and it will be sort of yellowish. Every stage bites. And then as it gets bigger, it turns reddish-brown, and the adults are flat. So you'll have about a fifth of an inch bug that is oval-shaped, flat, and reddish-brown.
And if you find it, let's say this is the biggest one, they get, and he's a big fella for his size, will it move for you?
They do. They walk about. They cannot fly. They cannot jump. They can cling to fabric. But everywhere they get by walking. And they walk about 1 inch a second.
And well, that's
so
pretty
fast. They move rapidly, but not so rapidly that they're going to scurry away like a silverfish and be out of your sight before you can see them again.
It wouldn't be, is this a piece of dirt or is this a bed bug?
No. The bed bug is going to be trying to get away from you if you disturb it. One interesting thing is that they are disturbed by air currents, and so if you're inspecting for them, if you have a can of compressed air, you can go along in cracks and crevices and use the air to blow into the crevice, and they're going to come out of there.
Yeah, but if you got cracks and crevices in your floor, Bill, you're going to blow a lot of stuff out of there. You're going to have a heart attack thinking it's all bed
bugs.
Yeah,
that's another thing you can do in terms of prevention, caulking up cracks and crevices along baseboards. That's a pretty good thing to do. If you can deny them hiding places, you're about 90% done with them.
Okay, so let's say that you have parasitosis right now. You woke up with a couple of what looked like bites on you. Obviously, it's never a bad idea to do a spring cleaning of the bedroom.
That's right. It wouldn't hurt in the least to take the bedding off, check your mattress, and see if you see anything that looks like bed bug eggs or cast-off skin or live bugs or blood spots.
And
if you don't, then you probably don't have bed bugs.
Good. And, you know, my family has allergies, and my children were both born with asthma. So we have always had allergy-proof encasers on our mattresses, and I presume that makes our mattresses very safe against bed bugs.
That's actually one of the things, if you suspect you have them or you have been exposed to them, It's a good idea. The encasements will keep the bugs from breeding in the mattress. The encasements they sell will trap them in there, and they won't be able to bite, and they'll just die.
So, okay, so we've cleaned our bedroom. We've encased our mattress. Now, one of the things I learned early on, which was just such common sense, and I really slapped myself, is whether it's in your bedroom or you're in a hotel room, don't put stuff on the floor, don't throw your clothes around, and don't allow your bedding, or, you know, your sheets and your comforter, to touch the floor, correct?
Yeah, that's it. Is that in a motel or a hotel, they probably, if you have them, they're going to be behind the headboard or something like that. So if you're really paranoid about it, you could take the headboard out if it's one of those adjustable ones that you can take out. Or when you bring in your luggage, like you say, don't put it on the bed, don't put it on the floor, and make sure that your bedding doesn't touch the floor in case that the bed bugs are close by and can crawl up on the bedding.
It seems like a little bit of caution could pay a long way here.
I think so. I think that as you're leaving a hotel, you should really inspect your luggage. I think that this is, in fact, how they're spreading. This is the resurgence that's come about, is that they spread internationally into hotels and places like that, and then people's domestic users of the hotel then go there and visit and then come back and bring the bed bugs home.
Now, let's reassure people. There is a simple trap that they can use in their bedroom that is marvelous in its simplicity, and it takes many forms. But once you have maybe rearranged your bedding so that it's not touching the floor, if you have a bed, a typical one that's off the floor on like a four-poster bed, if you put each of those legs inside something that has either oil or talcum powder or many other things in it, it will prevent bed bugs from going back and forth?
That is correct. They have to walk everywhere they go, and so the way they get on your bed is that they just crawl up the legs of the bed. But the traps themselves, you just fill it, like you say, either with soapy water, which is sort of messy, or with talcum powder, which is probably the best solution. One common way to do that is with a pet bowl. So if you have four pet bowls and you turn them upside down, then put talcum powder in the outer edge, this works fine.
So when you say pet bowl, you mean like a cat food can or a little margarine?
Cat food can would work, or just the feeding bowl for a cat or a dog.
Even a little margarine tub or a pint container, right?
Yeah. It's basically, the idea is a pitfall trap.
Right.
And so they climb into the trap, and then they get stuck in the talcum powder, and they can't climb up the bed.
And it also seems to me these would all be monitoring devices as well that would reveal whether or not you have a problem.
Yeah, and in fact, they've tested these, and they work very, very well.
It seems like if somebody out there is worried, again, nothing wrong ever with washing your linens, vacuuming your floor, getting the clutter off the floor, around your bed, putting on a mattress encaser, and you do that, and you drop the four legs of your bed into one of these very simple low-tech traps. Are we done, Bill?
I think you are.
All right. Well, I think this is all good news, Bill. I think we've really been able to reassure people. Now, if they go to your website, which is a very simple website, birc.org, will they find any bed bug information?
They will indeed. We have a former issue up there called Bed Bugs Bounce Back, and this latest one we're going to put up there in about another week or so.
Oh, Bill, that is excellent. Home run. Well, you know I'm a big fan of the work you do with your two journals. You've been in this business for some 30 years. I know you were just recently honored at an entomology conference, and you are a tremendously important source of information for me, and you've done great work over the years.
Well, thank you, Mike. That makes me feel good.
Bill Quarles, the director of the BIRC, the Biointegral Resource Center in Berkeley, California. He is the editor of the IPM Practitioner and Common Sense Pest Control, and you can find much more information online at their website, BIRC.org. Bill Quarles, keep up the good work. We'll talk to you again soon, and sleep tight and don't let the bed bugs bite.
Okay, thank you, Mike.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Rita, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for being had, Rita. Where are you?
In Turnersville, New Jersey.
Very good. What can we do for Rita in the Garden State?
Well, I've had a vegetable garden for years, and I'm finally ready to start some raised beds, and my problem is I have zoysia grass in my backyard. I would like to be able to put these raised beds right over the zoysia grass, and my question is there any way I can kill it off under the raised beds without digging it up?
I don't think zoysia grass can be killed, Rita, can it?
I don't think it can be either.
Yeah.
That's why I'm calling you.
It is a very tenacious grass. How deep are you going to make your raised beds?
Well, I bought some, ready-made frames that are, some composite type of, almost like a decking wood, and they're about 4 inches deep, but I can double them. I can make them 8 inches deep.
Oh, you got to.
Yeah.
You got to.
That's what I think. I think the 4 inches is too shallow.
Yeah, that's just a start. That's just something to, plant flowers in that's a little bit above. If you want vegetables, you got to go up 8 inches. I'll tell you the truth. The best answer is going to be to remove the grass once to get a sod cutter or use a linoleum knife to pull it up. Now, the zoysia grass in the full sun area where you're going to put your garden, that has to be thriving.
Yes, it is.
Do you have any sunny areas you can transplant it to, or do you have any neighbors who are interested in establishing a zoysia grass lawn?
I actually have a friend who just bought a house at the shore who's interested in some zoysia grass, and I told her I'd be very happy to give her some.
Yes and no. She has to come over and help you.
Oh, okay.
And what you're going to do is either rent a machine that's called a sod cutter, Or you're going to get very sharp knives. I did this with a linoleum knife when I started my garden. And you will cut foot-wide strips in the turf. You'll make it a foot across the top. Then you'll cut down 2-3 feet. And you'll roll these up and then cut them at the bottom. And it'll all lift up, roots and all. And then she can go lay it as sod, or as most people do, she can cut it up into parcels and put it throughout her lawn to be. Now, if she's down the shore, make sure she adds some compost to that sandy soil first.
Right.
Because that's something she's going to need to do. I would suggest you get, the zoysia grass out of there because it is so tenacious. Then when you're done, I would lay a single sheet of cardboard across all the ground. Your 4 foot wide raised beds, your 2 feet walking lanes, and then put wood chips or something over top of the cardboard in the lanes, and then fill your raised beds with half compost and half topsoil. If you wanted to try it without removing the zoysia grass, which I don't recommend, I would do 2 layers of cardboard. I would cover 2 layers of cardboard across the entire area, again, not just the beds themselves, no skimping. It would have to be beds and lanes. And I would even extend a barrier around that. And then I would say your raised beds need to be 3 of those sections high.
Oh, okay.
The smart money, it's like painting a room. The more work you do up front, which is generally during the time of year when the weather is still nice, when you're not out there dying, the more work you do up front, the longer the garden will last, the less work you'll have to do during the hottest part of the year. And you and I both know that zoysia grass takes a long rest over the winter, and when it comes back in the summer, it is raring to go.
Oh, Okay. I was afraid I was going to have to remove it. I thought about, you know, putting some kind of a barrier down, but I was afraid you would say the best thing is to remove it.
It's always the best thing to remove it. If you want to try a barrier, I would do two layers of cardboard and then build the raised beds high. But, you know, that zoysia grass on the outside is always, no matter what you do, going to come knocking. And I don't like the idea of it being down there. It's just so tenacious. And
Okay. And
even if you do remove the zoysia grass, obviously you're going to leave some perimeter around. So make sure you drive good edging into the ground to try to separate the garden area and the zoysia, because the more full sun, the more you're going to have a good garden, but the more the zoysia grass is going to want to move back in there.
Yeah, and how deep should that edging be?
I would make sure it's at least 6 inches below ground with a lip above ground.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. It may seem like a lot of work up front, but the results will be worth it.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Good luck, Rita.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and step outside to harvest some pansy flowers, lettuce, and spinach. Check on the progress of my snow pea patches. Replace the mulch around my garlic that I pulled back to let the soil warm up so I don't get weed woes. Raise the lights a little bit over my growing fast now starts. Slip plastic bags over my hands and pull the new poison ivy sprouts of the season. Spread some BTI granules in my vernal pools to allow toads but not mosquitoes to breed. What? Oh, yeah, right. And but don't you go saying it sounds like spring just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to use peanut shells safely in your garden and compost. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible with support from Seed Savers Exchange, whose 2011 Heirloom Seed Catalog, offering nearly 600 varieties, is now available. Learn more at seedsavers.org.
You're listening to WHYY. It's 11:38, 52 degrees now in Center City.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. There's still time to catch my act today at 1:30. At the Delaware County Environmental Fair at the Strathaven High School in Wallingford, PA. Next Saturday, April 16th, I'll appear at Homestead Gardens just outside of Annapolis. Then on Sunday, April 17th, I'll appear at 1 and 3 p.m. at the Health and Fitness Fair at the Newtown Athletic Club in Newtown, PA. This Tuesday, April 12th, the Scott Arboretum of Swarthmore College will host a free green roof tour at 12:30. And on Saturday, April 23rd, Laurel Hill Cemetery will host Nature in the Necropolis, a tour of the historic resting place's famed horticulture. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
In the WHYY forecast, mostly sunny today, the high 61. Tonight, overcast with a low of 47. Some showers about tomorrow morning, but then sunshine for later Sunday, the high 62. And Monday's high could get up to 82. Right now it's 52 degrees.
Supporting WHYY, Chester County Hospital. Did you know that snoring or skipping the dentist could affect heart health? Chester County Hospital is offering an online cardiac risk assessment to help you understand risk factors. Online at ChesterCountyHospital.org.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. Almost everyone in the country has access to peanut shells. They are just such a common commodity. But are they a good thing to use as a mulch on the surface of the soil? And are they a good thing to mix into your compost piles? I'll have the surprising answers for you after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Dan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing good, Dan. How are you, sir?
I'm doing really well. Glad to be on the show.
Well, it's good to have you on the show, sir. What can we do you for?
Well, I sent you an email about aquaponics, and I'd wondered if you had heard anything about it, and it didn't really seem like you had.
Oh, you're the guy, am I correct that you were growing lettuce in essentially in a fish tank with living fish supplying the nutrients?
Yeah, that's about it. I mean, we were growing lettuce and some basil. We tried spinach too, but spinach didn't do too well. But yeah, we were using fish to grow our lettuce.
Now, tell us a little bit about your setup.
So how it works is we had a 10-gallon fish tank that we filled with goldfish, maybe 10 or 12 goldfish. And then on top of that, we had a plastic bin, and we just drilled some holes into it and filled it with expanded clay beads. They're called hydroton. They're used pretty commonly in aquaponics or hydroponics. So what happens is the water from the fish tank is pumped from the fish tank into the grow bed, and the water from the fish tank has a bunch of ammonia in it, and then bacteria convert the ammonia into nitrates, and the plants use the nitrates and essentially clean the water for the fish. It's recirculating water, and it mimics a real ecosystem.
Now, you're saying the water, quote, contains ammonia. Are you being delicate here? Is this...
it's fish poop.
You know, we're always telling people it's not only safe, but it's great for your gardens when you clean out your fish tanks, you know, to use that poopy water to irrigate your garden in the summertime because it's full of nutrients. Am I correct that there's no other filter in your fish tank other than this living filter of whatever plant roots are in that expanded clay?
You're absolutely correct. Sometimes you have to watch out for the buildup of solid waste. Some solids can mess with your water pump, but that's really the only time you would ever need to go in and manually get something out.
What did you do for light? Where is this?
We had it on a windowsill on the second floor of a house, but we had a grow light that we ran during daylight hours.
Okay. You know, because the lettuce, if it doesn't get enough natural light, you were even talking about nitrates and how lettuce can convert the nitrates into a soluble form of plant nitrogen. But you have to be careful about lettuce grown in low light conditions, if I'm remembering correctly. But you can have nitrates build up in the food if there's not an intense enough bright light. So that's really the only thing you have to add. Most people have lights above their fish tanks anyway.
Yeah, I mean, ideally you would want a grow light with a full spectrum of light, like a fluorescent wouldn't do it. But yeah, I mean, a regular grow light would do it. You don't need a whole lot.
Well, that's where we differ here, man. Because we used to experiment with grow lights all the time at Organic Gardening, especially when we were exhibitors in the Philadelphia Flower Show. And we found that keeping plants really close to a set of four-foot-long, 40-watt fluorescent tubes provided everything the plants needed. I know they're supposed to need these extra spectrums of light that these fluorescents didn't provide, but luckily our plants were all illiterate and had never read these books and came out tasting perfect and testing perfect. So one, you know, half cool white and half warm white 40-watt fluorescent tubes, I think gives you more lumens and better results than expensive grow lights.
Well, that sounds great. It's a nice little financial shortcut if you want to start your own little system.
Why do you think your spinach failed?
The spinach might have failed just because it wasn't getting all the nutrients it needed. I mean, people have grown a really diverse range of things in aquaponic setups, but it really just depends. You have to experiment. Each one's going to be a little bit different depending on, you know, your water source and how you take care of it. But people have grown, you know, marigolds, onions, peppers, tomatoes do really well, zucchini, jalapeno peppers, peas, carrots even.
The one thing I'll add to our listeners, it's one thing to supply enough artificial light to keep lettuce happy. Once you get to those fruiting crops, then you're into... like real high intensity light that's needed and some, you know, sometimes pollination issues. But I tell you, the idea of doing salad greens and herbs this way sounds fantastic.
Yep, and those are the easiest to grow.
All right. Well, Dan, thank you for sharing your experience with aquaponics with us.
Hey, thanks. And you should check out backyardaquaponics.com. They've got a whole host of resources.
Backyardaquaponics.com. All right. Thank you, Dan.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Take care.
You too. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Laura, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Laura. Where are you?
I'm in Ringo's, New Jersey.
All right. Well, what can we do for Laura in the Garden State?
We are hoping to plant some raspberries this year with our brand new garden. And we're not sure where to place those raspberry bushes relative to the garden space.
As far away from the formal garden as you can manage.
Okay.
Raspberries are absolutely wonderful plants. They are the easiest fruit to grow. Once they're established, they'll give you two harvests a year. They're one of the two or three most nutritious things we can eat, and they practically grow themselves. But their habit, their growing habit, is to grow via spreading canes. So the natural inclination of a raspberry patch is to always be on the move. It is not a static plant like a blueberry bush or an apple tree. Now, are you building a raised bed garden for summer vegetables?
The vegetable garden is going to be about a 30 by 30 space. And we, instead of raised bed, I guess it's just sort of a mounded bed is what we're going to start with.
And do you have an area that's in an out-of-the-way space that's not doing anything where perhaps the soil isn't the best, but it, there would be plenty of room for plants to spread out and multiply?
The space that we are considering for all of this is on the west side of our house, and it's actually in a field. It's on the edge of our lawn, and it's about 2 acres.
Oh, okay.
So we have a lot of space, but as far as watering considerations and so forth, that edge of the field is the closest edge to the house is about 100 feet from our closest water source. So we weren't sure, considering that, where we should place both of these kinds of gardens.
Okay, the first thing I'm going to suggest is that you change your mind about the mounded beds then.
Okay.
Because framed beds covered by a nice inch or two of a non-wood mulch, like dried clippings from an herbicide-free lawn or shredded fall leaves, they're going to go much longer between waterings, and they're going to do much better in a drought situation.
Okay.
Raspberries will only require supplemental water, and I shouldn't say that they even necessarily will, but the only time they would is when they're getting established.
Okay.
And that's in the spring, which is typically a pretty good time. The enemy of raspberries is just the opposite. It's an area that doesn't drain well, where there's too much water. That's the only thing that'll hold raspberries back. But I would say that the irrigation should not be an issue. You can still run a hose and a sprinkler from the house 100 feet. That's not that bad. So what you want to do is either buy your canes in the spring, or do you know anybody who grows raspberries?
I do.
Go to their place in the spring and have them tell you which of the new canes that are emerging from the soil that they can do without. And you'll dig up those canes and take them back, and you'll plant them in your field after you've tilled the soil or whatever you're going to do to, you know, help the raspberries get off to a good start. Maybe throw some compost down there in the very beginning, as much to keep some moisture in the soil. Either do this right before we're supposed to get a week's worth of rain, or do set up that sprinkling system and just make sure they get watered well, either by you or by rain, for like the first month after they go in the ground. That's the critical time. And then after that, it should be off to the races, and you should get a harvest at the end of this summer. And then leave the canes up. Don't listen to anybody who tells you to mow them down. And in the early summer, you'll get a second harvest from those same canes. Then those individual canes will die.
Okay.
But by then, you'll have a whole new slew of canes to replace them and start the cycle over again.
That sounds good.
All right.
All right. Well, I appreciate it very much. We'll look forward to those raspberries.
They are fabulous. They're easy to grow. Just keep them away from areas where other plants are wanted.
Okay. Thank you so much, Mike.
All right. My pleasure. Good luck, Laura.
All right. Have a great day.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Do peanut shells make good mulch or compost? Our first email comes from Rick in Box Springs, Georgia, which he says is near Columbus. Mike, what do you think a peanut holds as a mulch? A local plant that makes peanut products gives them away. I used them last year in my garden, and they were effective at controlling weeds, though I did get a few volunteer peanut plants. And they don't seem to carry any disease. What will they add or take away from my soil? Michelle, in the very southeastern corner of Alabama, Daleville, writes, do you think peanut hulls, which are available in my area, both whole and ground up, would be a better or worse mulch than wood chips? Thanks. Stan in Phenix City, Alabama, which he says is 100 miles southwest of Atlanta, writes, this will be my third year trying to be a successful tomato grower. I'm making compost according to your instructions and don't use any chemical fertilizer. A gardening friend has told me that decomposed peanut hulls make an excellent compost for tomatoes. Is this true? It seems to me that the peanut hulls would be similar to wood chips or bark, and therefore would, pardon my pun, be a no-no. Thank you for your program and all your advice. Well, you're welcome, Stan. And finally, we wade into Christopher in York, Pennsylvania, which he describes as west of the Susquehanna and north of the Mason-Dixon line. I'm a novice gardener and would like to know if large quantities of peanut hulls would be desirable for garden mulch or as compost ingredients. A potential source is nearby, and I noticed that peanut hulls were listed as an ingredient in a tomato container mix I used successfully some years ago. Thank you for all your great information. I currently support two public radio stations. Good for you, Chris. Well, as I expressed out loud on a recent show, I had this nagging thought that somebody had warned me something about peanut shells. Luckily, we didn't need to trust my memory any further than that, as I can file with the best of them. And I quickly found the references that our unsurpassed, unpaid fact-finding fanatic Charles Younger sent me last September. Following the reference trails, I found many extension agents repeating the same warning. Don't use peanut shells as a mulch in the South, as they can harbor southern blight and other fungal diseases and may contain, quote, nematodes, which could only in this circumstance refer to the nasty southern root knot nematode and not the beneficial critters we good little organic gardeners rely on for controlling grub, flea, and other pest problems. Now, these warnings were all suspiciously identical to each other, and one of the delicate dances I have to do every day is try and evaluate whether warnings like this mean it's likely to happen, as in wooden bark mulches breeding nuisance molds, or it could theoretically happen. And extension agents often feel an obligation to cite every bad thing that could possibly happen. But several of the extension articles also linked to longer articles on southern blight that included photos of the disease, and I would not wish that kind of devastation on anyone. Luckily, all of the references I found, and an article we did on locally available bulk organic matter in Organic Gardening magazine back in 94, recommend peanut shells as an excellent compost pile ingredient. And so I say to you organic gardeners, north and south, east and west, yes, compost your peanut shells. Original research we did at the magazine also found that, probably because they're a legume, peanut hulls are surprisingly nitrogen rich. Now they're also brown material as opposed to green, which even I find confusing. Welcome to my world, kids. You try and figure this stuff out. So I'm going to punt here and just say to shred them up well, wet them down, and mix them up with a lot of other stuff. But no matter what, they shouldn't do anything bad as a compost ingredient. Now we get to mulch. Rich, in the wonderfully named Box Springs, Georgia, right next door to Mattress, notes in his email, which, like most of your emails, is asking the relative wisdom of something you've already done, he notes that he saw no disease problems using a peanut shell mulch, strongly implying that he had seen the same warnings I did. Now, the fact that you tried something and nothing bad happened the first year is no guarantee of its wisdom, and I can't get those blight pictures out of my mind. So it is with some regret that I suggest our southern listeners compost their shells and find another mulch, like the finished peanut hull containing compost, which all sources agree is no longer suspect. Ah, but what of our listener in York, Pennsylvania, who even points out that he is north of the Mason-Dixon line? But not by much, I'll note here. Some of the extension warnings about mulch specify that they only apply to the south. So, can he use his locally available bulk peanut shells as a mulch? I might. They are nitrogen-rich and not all carbon like wood, so they will cause none of the problems of wood mulch or sawdust like plant starvation and nuisance molds. And the fungal diseases they might harbor are not a problem in a northern climate. Now, is it impossible for them to occur in the north? Heck no. You get a summer as hot and wet as they get in St. Louis or Alabama, and spores are spores. But they wouldn't overwinter in the north, so they'd only be a one-season problem. So I just might use them. Above that Mason-Dixon line, of course. Well, that sure was some interesting advice on how to use peanut shells safely now, wasn't it? Luckily, yous can read the print version of this and every question of the week at the Gardens Alive website. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to infect me with southern blight if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please, please, please tell us where you live. Please, please, please put the actual subject in the subject line. And you know, you might want to check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you on a silver tray at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our alphabetized archive of garden answers. And or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Kevin Love Train Griffin. Our webmasters are Rich, master of the Savage Server, Banowitz, and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar. Our intern, Jessica Mandick, has been known to walk on a mulch of peanut shells. Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, says she prefers peanut butter. Smooth as butter is our esteemed editor, Al Banks. I'm smooth as a jar of extra chunky, Mike McGrath. And I'll see you next week. Window boxes are a very popular way to display plants in the country and the city. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll help you adorn your windows with boxes that work well, plus your fabulous phone calls.
Mike cuts through the cacophony of advice to offer with candor capable counsel as to the organic growing of cabbages, calendula, carrots, even catalpa.